This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Today, we don't have a sponsor for the show, but if you'd like to sponsor us, you can get in touch with us through our website at outofschool.net. Now, good morning, Bradley. I normally say good evening, but I think it's a different time of day for both of us today.
Yes, it is 5:06 a.m., and I woke up about 5 minutes ago. I had my alarm set for 4:45 so I could make some coffee, and I had laid back down to go to sleep, apparently, and my wife said, hey, don't you need to get up? Of course, I had a backup alarm set that would come on at 5 to 5, but I have my coffee, and I'm ready to go.
That's the joy of time zones, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Can you imagine if it was even further apart? I mean, I don't even know how you would do that.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky. I guess we should probably say we're going to have a sit-in host for you in a couple of weeks' time. Obviously, as people know, your wife's expecting a baby soon. So my friend Don Orth from a school called Hillbrook in California is going to come on the show for a couple of weeks. So we are then 8 hours apart instead of the 5 that we're normally apart. So it's going to be, I think I'm going to be doing a couple of late shows late into the night. So.
Yeah, she is about, not that anybody really cares, but she is about 4 centimeters dilated, and it's July 1st, and she was 4 centimeters earlier this week. So the doctor said, have a bag packed, because you could really go at any time, and if you're any more dilated when you come to the doctor this next week, we go on Wednesday. Of course, this show will already be out, or the appointment will have passed by the time the show's released, but you know, he said May send you to the hospital. So she is not due until the 20th. So, but the baby is growing rapidly, and apparently has a full head of hair. So,
wow. Okay, not a full set of teeth.
No. We are, and like my son has, for whatever reason, has this habit this week of getting up in the middle of the night and wanting to watch TV. And so he comes out. He comes out last night, and we have the monitor, and we hear him getting up. So my wife says, "Go see what he wants." And I go out there, and he says, "Hey, Daddy, I want to watch TV now." And it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. And you're like, well, buddy, it's time to go back to bed. And he says, will you come lay down with me? Because he's almost 3. So, yeah, I'll come lay down with you. He goes, I want some juice. And so you kind of roll your eyes at him, but it's like it's 2 in the morning, so you kind of don't care. It's like he could ask for 50 bucks, and I would have given him 50 bucks.
You just hand him an iPad and Netflix and go back to bed.
Oh, absolutely. Right? And so I go and give him some juice, and he was coughing, so I gave him some Benadryl. He was coughing pretty bad, and I think that's what woke him up. So I get up there, and he goes, I want some Cheez-Its, Daddy. And I said, Cheez-Its? 2 o'clock in the morning. I get him some Cheez-Its, and I lay down with him, and I go to sleep. And he goes to sleep, I'm assuming, because about 4.5 hours later, I roll over and look at him, and he's looking at me with eyes wide open, you know, 6:30 in the morning.
And he goes, what happened in the meantime?
I know, you don't even know. And he goes, I want to watch, it's Bubble Guppies, which is a show on Nickelodeon. But he calls it Bubby Guppies or Bubby Buppies or something because, you know, that's how the kids talk. And he's in a great mood. And that's the thing. It's not like he's in a bad mood. He's cranky. Like, he is happy as a lark. And he has probably got no sleep. Of course, he was in a bad mood most of the day and actually ended up running a fever and whatnot. And that was it was a fun Sunday.
Yeah, so it's all fun and games until the next day.
Yes. So the joys of parenthood, and like when we have this going on, knowing my wife is weeks, if not days, away from having a newborn, I realize I am so screwed.
Yeah. Yep. Wait till you have 3. That's all I'm going to say.
Honestly, we have a school parent who they're very, very nice people. They have 5, and their last set was twins. And I don't even know how you don't even just go crazy with that. I know. I think
that the horror of that is always, well, not the horror, that's putting it too strongly, but the shock is always when you've got, you know, 3 kids and then you're expecting number 4 and you actually get number 5 along with it as well.
Oh, yeah, because you probably weren't, like, especially maybe a 4 wasn't totally planned, and yeah, I don't...
4 is definitely enough. Oh, no, it's 5.
Now, logistically, 3 has to change things a lot, especially as they get older, like with traveling and things like that.
Yeah. We're actually about to take our first trip with the new baby next week. We're heading over to Ireland to visit my wife's family, and we're going to pack the car pretty full. We've got a new car last year. We're driving a Ford S-Max now. I don't know if you guys have that car in the States, but it's kind of like a kind of 7-seater people carrier type thing, but with small seats in the back. So we've got that and a roof box, just for the equipment that you have to take. It's like a military campaign.
Well, because you got to take like the pack and play little portable bed. I often wonder if it would just not be cheaper just to like be able to rent that stuff as you travel, all the stuff you have to take. Because it feels like the younger you are, the more stuff you need.
For sure, yeah. Oh, my wife has got this great trick for traveling when you go on a self-catering holiday. We have a lot of supermarkets in the UK now offer like internet ordering and delivery of groceries. So the ninja move when you're doing a self-catering holiday is to order your internet groceries to be delivered to the holiday house so that you don't have to take them in the car with you when you travel. It took us so long to just realize that was a thing you could do, but once we realized it, we take so much less stuff now.
We really don't have that option where I live. I think there's a couple places you can order groceries, but it's more of expensive. It's not really something you do. There's no good economics with it. Apparently Amazon's working on that. So yeah, that would be nice, because we generally when we travel and go on vacation, we take a lot of food with us, just because it's like, if you need milk and you already have a half gallon of milk at home, you might as well just take it with you. But, it's funny. I may have mentioned this before. When you're a kid and you go on vacation, you're riding. And I can imagine it now. They've got iPads, and it's just life is so much easier now for kids with traveling. We just sat there. You had a magazine you colored.
Yeah. And you tried not to be sick.
Oh, exactly. And then you become the dad and you realize, I've got to drive this entire way and not complain about it and stay awake. And you just realize that this really stinks, and the kids have it so much easier.
Yeah. My girls, their latest thing is they have a couple of old iPad 1s. They have one each. And it used to be that they were quite happy just to have a movie loaded onto their iPad and watch that for the trip. But now the latest thing is that they're demanding that I set up a personal hotspot on my phone so that they can surf YouTube while we're driving. Every time I do that, I'm sort of I don't really think I should be doing this, but I'm doing it anyway. And actually, it turns out that what they really wanted it for, apart from YouTube, was so that they had a network between each device so they could Minecraft on each other's iPad while they were driving. Or while I was driving, I should say. So just driving along in a little cloud of Wi-Fi keeps the kids happy.
Well, yeah, my son is just at the age that he's starting to understand internet and Netflix, and he knows that he likes to be able to watch shows wherever he's at, but doesn't understand he can't just say, I want to watch this episode of Bubble Guppies, and doesn't understand that we don't always have that available. I mean, we at home we do, but when we're just in the car, we don't really without have turning on tethering or whatnot, we don't have that available. And it's just like kids these days. It's when I was a kid, we had to watch one DVD and we liked it. And the kids nowadays, they just
and if you missed your show, you were waiting a week for it to come back on.
Oh yeah, there was no iTunes and purchasing it for $2. But what's funny, our guest network at work has that kind of peer-to-peer discovery turned off. And so our students' devices that they bring just for free time, they will play Minecraft, and the number one complaint I get is that it doesn't allow that to work. And I get so many requests from our students, Mr. Chambers, can you turn it on so we can see each other in Minecraft? And it's no, I'm sorry, but there's security reasons for that. It's actually, it's not, I just want to play Minecraft. And it's funny, it's a game that looks like it would be out when we were kids, not in 2013.
Yeah, Minecraft is just such a big deal now. It's incredible. We should probably have a show all about administering Minecraft servers or something. Okay, so, kids these days. I was going to say one other thing. The thing I find constantly fascinating about my girls and their attitude to, media consumption is that for them, YouTube is basically video. I mean, YouTube is video, but it's also television. They don't understand. We have, BBC iPlayer is kind of our equivalent of Hulu Plus in the US, and BBC iPlayer has all these rules where shows come on, they're on for 7 days, and then they go away. And to them, iPlayer is just like a broken version of YouTube, because YouTube, nothing ever goes off YouTube. You can always find it. It's just maybe a different URL at a different time, but you can always find Mater's Tall Tales or whatever on YouTube. And I was trying to kind of VPN to America and then go into the US Netflix and watch Mater's Tall Tales there because it's not streamable in the UK. And Beth, my 6-year-old, she was like, Dad, why don't you just get it on YouTube? It's always on YouTube. So YouTube has become all television for children.
Well, and then if you're really snazzy, I'm not obviously condoning this, like you can use one of those websites or apps to rip the video off of YouTube, and then you have it forever.
Yes, indeed.
So yeah, Mater Saltels is hilarious.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan. I mean, it's weird because, you know, because it works, they have no concept that it's not necessarily legal. It's a weird thing. I think it's and it's hard to kind of explain to them, you know? They're like, because when you say, well, that's not really, you know, that's not really a legitimate copy of Mater's Tall Tales. I mean, through Netflix, I've paid for it and it's licensed and the whole bit. And a six-year-old's like, licensing? What are you talking about? You know, all she knows is one works and one's more awkward to use. And the BBC one sometimes stops working just because. And I guess that's, you look at it through a child's eyes, that's the broken media world we live in.
Well, because, I mean, when I was in high school when Napster came out, and of course I remember we actually put it on the school computers at the time. Of course, how we did that, I don't know. But you could at least like understand that, like, you were going through a lot of trouble to download some music. And so we were old enough to really understand maybe this isn't totally on the up and up. But with YouTube, it's like, that's where I go when I want to watch funny videos of cats. That's where I go when I want to find highlights of things. And, you know, it is one of those, like, it's tough to explain that to a kid because it's like, it's just a website. Google owns it. I mean, shouldn't it all be legal on there? Yeah, it's...
Well, this is the tricky thing about it is that it's owned by the biggest internet company in the world. How can that not be legit? You know, but when they're getting, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 hours per hour of content uploaded, then, you know, it's pretty difficult for them to catch everything.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, if anybody's wondering why my audio sounds different, I don't have my regular mic with me. I had left it at work and did not want to drive to work. So please bear with me. I have my iPhone headset. So if I sound terrible, that is, it's not just that it's 5 a.m. here, it's that I have a terrible mic.
It's a combination of factors.
Yeah. See, the downside now is I need more coffee, and it's like all the way downstairs. So I'm out of luck.
Well, we're going to talk about a couple of different things today, Bradley. Number one, I've just finished installing our Casper server for this year, which has been a fairly interesting little task. It's not been particularly difficult, but I thought we'd maybe just have a quick chat about it. And then we're going to just get into some listener feedback as well, because some of that's built up and it's time to, I was going to say drain the swamp, but that's not right, because we enjoy our listener feedback. It's going to drain the pipe, I think, is probably what we should say instead. So Casper, we sent away our purchase order, I think a couple of weeks ago we were talking about that, and basically the way that Casper gets delivered to you is that you Jamf make a lot of use of their Jamf Nation user forum. And having your login there is basically the same thing as, well, it's basically your account with Jamf. So it lets you participate in the forums, but also through that site, you get access to things like your activation code and also downloads. Once they're credited to your account, once the purchase goes through, that's where you go to download your assets, if you like. And so basically I just logged into my Jamf Nation account and I've got a new tab that says assets, and I download an installer package and a license code for Jamf, for Casper. And I decided, the way I decided we were going to deploy it was, I had a Mac Mini here that wasn't being used for very much useful things. So I set that up with a new install of a Mountain Lion server, put the server app on it, and just installed Casper. Now, there is an installer package for it. There's a couple of things you've got to install first over the base install of Mountain Lion server. Number one is Java, because it's a Tomcat web app. So downloading and installing Java is not the most obvious thing you can do on Apple's website, but eventually I found it. Apple's not making quite such a big fuss of Java on the Mac these days as they used to, but there's clearly enough going on to keep it running for servers. So installed that. And then the other thing you've got to install is MySQL, which was, you know, I mean, I've been installing MySQL for years and years and years, and it used to be a fairly baroque process on the Mac to install MySQL properly, but now, and it has been for quite a few years now, it's packaged very nicely. There's an installer package, there's a startup item, and there's a control panel for MySQL. So it's pretty trivial just to run through that, set it up. And then there's just a wee bit of command line stuff you've got to do just to set up the database for Casper and create a user in MySQL for Casper. And once you put those database settings into the Casper installer, just hit go and you're done. And that's really it, getting set up. Obviously, you want to have DNS set up for your server correctly before you start installing Casper, but that's something you should really be doing as part of installing OS X server in the first place. So that probably took me about an hour total, and most of that was spent poking around Apple's website trying to find the current version of Java for OS X. But yeah, it was very, very painless install. You just go to the login page, set up some accounts, and then put in your activation code, and you're up and running. So that's Casper.
You purchased it. We talked before, you had to buy like the installation help. So you didn't even use that.
I haven't had it yet. Now, it's interesting. I've kind of been characterizing it as installation help. And I think what the jumpstart really is, if I'm being more precise about it, is that it's kind of like a half day's training on how to administer and use Casper rather than just somebody's going to install it for you. Because I think my understanding of it now that I've actually been through the process is really that you get the software yourself, you install it yourself, and obviously you don't want to have to communicate passwords with somebody who works for Jamf, so I control the passwords and so on. We haven't actually scheduled our jumpstart yet, but we're going to do that sometime over the summer. And I guess what I'm looking for there is really more kind of what's the best practices for setting up smart groups, kinds of profiles, that sort of stuff. I mean, a lot of that I've already thought about, but it'll be interesting to see if there's more experience that I can gain from people at Jamf as to what they see as being the best way to do some of that stuff.
What's the process on like Git? Because I know it integrates in with Arrowhive's Hive Manager. Like, what's that process like? Have you done that yet?
I have, yep. It's pretty straightforward. Basically, in Casper, they have the concept of multiple different accounts and roles. So you can connect it to your LDAP server, and it supports Active Directory, Open Directory, and so on. So you can say, for certain groups in your Active Directory, they get certain privileges. And the basic privilege that I'm giving to people in our Open Directory server is enroll mobile devices. And that's the only thing those accounts can do. So what I did was I created another account called Arrowhive, and all Arrowhive user can do is query the status of mobile devices. There's maybe 20 or 30 different privileges you can give an account. So I just give that account one privilege, and it's got its own password and user. So then what you do is you take that account information and go over to the Hive Manager in Arrowhive and say, for this SSID, into the advanced section of configuration for your SSID, you say, check in with an MDM server, and you give the username and password for the Arrowhive user on your Casper server, and then the two can talk to each other. And of course, because that Arrowhive account doesn't have very many privileges, you're sort of minimizing your security risk as well, because there's not a lot that user can do. Even if your Hive Manager get compromised in some way, all the attacker would be able to do in your Casper would be to check whether or not certain devices were enrolled. So that's how that works together, and it's really just set it and forget it. There's not a lot of controls to it. And there's some documentation on Arrowhive's website about just what privileges you need to give in Casper for that account so that Arrowhive can do its thing.
In some ways I still find it not funny, but I guess like perplexing that Jamf doesn't have like a hosted solution, kind of one click. I know a company called Maz360 does a hosted hosted MDM. I know, of course, Meraki's is as well. Mm-hmm. And you just wonder, like, are customers asking for that? Maybe it's a smaller school that really doesn't have a full time technical person, or the technical person doesn't want to deal with it, and they would just love to be able to click a button and buy something. And so I'm just perplexed on why, I guess, Jamf doesn't move in that direction.
My understanding is that there are some Casper resellers who do offer that as a solution. I think the main reason that that's not really the way that Casper is deployed usually is because Casper as a whole suite actually has a lot more to it than just being an MDM for iOS devices. And in fact, I'm kind of buying this big system and I'm only using one part of it, because the other big part of Casper is managing macOS 10 computers. And to do a lot of the things that they do for OS 10, you actually have to have the server on your network. So it's things like net booting Macs, providing software distribution points and things like that. And that's the kind of bandwidth intensive stuff that you would want to have on your network anyway. So, you know, looking at it from the point of view of just wanting an iOS MDM, then yes, it's maybe a bit much to host it on your own machine, put it on your own network and so on. If you were using the full suite to manage both Macs and iOS devices, it would make a lot more sense to have it as a host, as a self-hosted thing on your own network.
Makes sense. I didn't think. I'm more thinking about for managing iOS devices, but yeah. I forgot about the Mac, and there is so much, you know, there is so much that it can do with the Mac that you can do elsewhere.
There's a lot of scoping things you can do in Casper where it's based on which network segment people are coming to your server from. And if the server is outside your network, it doesn't actually have visibility into that stuff. So if you host your Casper outside your own network, you actually can't use some of those features because it doesn't have enough visibility into your network to do some of that stuff.
Do you have it set, like when devices go off network, will they still check in with the MDM, or is it basically only something when they're inside the network?
Yeah, no, I've set it up so it's accessible from everywhere. So I've opened some ports to that machine. So that people's devices can check in from home as well. Because one of my kind of plans for our next deployment is just that I want people to basically keep their iPad for 3 years, and I don't really want to have to bring it back in every summer if I don't have to, so that we can continue to manage and push stuff to the devices, both evenings and weekends and holidays as well. So it's available everywhere, but we're hosting it on-site.
Sounds like a painless installation process, really. I mean, of course, it's always funny that Java is the hardest part of it. Java will drive you nuts.
Yeah.
Our air conditioning controllers are, you interface them to a web interface, and they're Java. And I had one of the guys that manages them. He has his Java installed on his machine. You go to Java's website, run the test. It says, hey, you're patched, you're up to date, ready to go. You go to the air conditioning controller, it doesn't load. You go to another computer and it loads. And so you're like, what is the disconnect? Like, it says we have Java installed. It won't load, but it works on another machine. And I think what it is like he's got a version of Java that's not compatible with it, because I'm sure like he has the newest version, but the version of Java on the air conditioning controller is the oldest one. Who knows?
But a range of pains. Okay, so I thought we would maybe get into doing a little bit of feedback.
Yeah.
We've got a few, and some of it a little old, so apologize for some people who haven't heard the feedback in a while, but we'll just get into it and see what's going on. So first one we've got comes from Matthew Seeger, who says, having recently listened to episode 27, it's taken a while to get to this, I purchased and read Nevermind the Laptops, which was a book that we referred to a while back. And he says, one thing that I've struggled to reconcile is the tension between the desire for equity in which the school buys versus a desire for parent or student buy-in and ownership to some kind of one-to-one program. He says that he works at a low-fee private school with a number of students from low socioeconomic backgrounds, so the school has a big focus on equity. A technology levy probably won't get past the board. And he asks, does ownership have to extend as far as parents paying, or is it enough for students to be given responsibility for managing and controlling their own devices, and will they look after a freebie? So I think this is a really interesting question, and it's one that comes up again and again and again when you talk to schools who are wanting to go one-to-one, but they don't obviously have the slack in their budget to do it. And I actually had this conversation with somebody who visited the school just a couple of days ago as well. Does it matter to children that they didn't themselves or they don't themselves legally own the device, because obviously we at Cedars have leased the devices ourselves, and pupils are assigned the device and take it home and look after it, but they don't actually own it themselves. What's your take on this one, Bradley?
You know, we're in this similar boat that we're a no-fee private school. So when you pay your tuition, that actually includes everything other than lunch. And you can add your lunch on. So I'm in the same boat. You know, I could argue till I was blue in the face on both ends that if there's no money being spent, that people won't take care of them, then I also think, well, if that's your school model is a no-fee or a low-fee, then does it make sense to introduce a fee just for this? And then I guess I'm reminded, and let's take a, you know, I guess let's look maybe 20 years in the future and how we view technology. It'll probably be how we view textbooks today. And students could very easily mark in textbooks, drop them in a puddle of water, spill their Coke on them, you know, rub peanut butter in them, and we seem to survive. So if that's your model, I think that's the model you've got to continue to go with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you can't build some way in to, I guess, hold parents and students responsible if devices are broken, then you're just going to have to prepare for the damage. And obviously you want to teach good kind of citizenship of the device and teach them how to take care of them and really instill that in them. But just be prepared that, hey, maybe 1-3% of these things may be dropped and broken, and we're just going to have to deal with that, or maybe stolen or whatnot. It is tough, but I guess I look at it in, let's look at an iPad, for example, or a laptop as a function of our teaching process, just as we do a very expensive school book. Because if you think about it, if you're handing out 5 or 6 books to a kid, you're probably getting close to the cost of certainly an iPad mini, but it's quite possible that you're getting close to the cost of a full size iPad with, mm-hmm. you know, how textbooks are, you know, $50 and $60 a piece. So it's a tough problem, but I think I would err on sticking to the kind of the mantra of your school. And so if it's a low fee or a no fee, just stick with that.
I think that's a really good answer, because quite often the thing I always say to people when we talk about, you know, planning for a one-to-one program is, you've got to think about this question, but I can't necessarily tell you the answer to it because the answer is specific to your school. Our experience has been that the difference is not about legal ownership as much as named responsibility. And what I mean by that is that even down to 5-year-olds here, when we deploy an iPad to those kids, we'll put their name on it. And that's their iPad, and that's the one they're using. And I think there's a big difference between doing that and doing here's 20 iPads, let's just use one today, cart-based model. And we've seen, you know, in the laptop era and before, that people don't really look after something that they're not accountable for looking after. But if your name is on that device and it comes back broken, then the only person who's going to be asked questions about it is you. Because it's your device with your name on it, and I'm going to ask you what happened to it because you're looking after it. And we found that it doesn't really matter too much whether or not the pupil legally owns that device as much as whether they are named as being accountable for it. And we found that our pupils look after their iPads incredibly carefully because it is theirs. And the only person that impacts if it gets broken is them. You know, it's not like they can break it and laugh at somebody else who's now got a broken iPad because they did something wrong with it. It's the only person who's going to get hammered for it is you. You're going to just be without an iPad for a while. One other thing that I think impacts this quite a lot is the schools who make a really big song and dance about their insurance policy often experience much higher damage rates than schools that don't. It's not actually about whether or not they've got an insurance policy, but whether or not they promote it to everybody as being a thing that we've got. So there are some schools where they've said, we've got this great insurance policy, all risks are covered, unlimited claims, just don't worry about it, it's always going to be fine. And at that point, kids are just like, well, if this thing's covered, you know, it's like wearing a seatbelt and driving more riskily. The more you tell people it's going to be okay, the more they're going to behave in a way that may require you to activate that insurance at some point. So we obviously have insurance cover for our devices, but we don't really make a big deal about it. When we deploy, we tend to say, look, here's your iPad. You really got to look after it. If something terrible happens, we can help you fix it. But here's, you know, who's responsible for it at certain times. What we do actually is we say that if the device is damaged in school, during school hours, that the school will cover that cost. But if it's damaged outside of school after hours, then the parents are going to have to cover that cost. And the cost is not necessarily the full replacement cost of an iPad unless it's lost. It's usually just the out-of-warranty repair fee that Apple charges, which is about half the cost of an iPad here. It's about £190. And we've activated that a couple of times. And parents have generally been okay with that. Some parents insure their iPads on their home insurance. I don't think it's necessary for it to be parent-funded in order to build that kind of culture of responsibility. But you do have to be aware that it is a culture-building problem. It's not just a matter of saying, well, you paid for it, you take care of it. You've got to kind of make that part of your school culture as well.
Well, and I guess the struggle for parents is, as we integrate it further and further into our curriculum, you can't really be without it for very long without it impacting the student on a learning level. So it is, you have that balance. But I like that. I like the way you guys do it with, hey, if it's broken here, we'll handle it. If it's broken at home, it's on you. And because that, it divides up the responsibility. You know, so if a parent sees their student kind of acting, you know, if they're at the pool and they're getting a little too close to the edge, they've got some responsibility there, because if it's, you know, dropped in the pool at this moment, it's going to be their parents' responsibility to do that.
Yeah. Yep. I think it's a tricky one and it's a challenge, but you can definitely get over it. Okay. Next, shall we move on? Next one, Jeffrey Blackburn invites us to Alaska. He just says he works with a technology and a blended program up in Alaska. He says it can feel a bit isolated up here, and I love the feeling of community I get when I hear that we all seem to be answering similar questions and facing similar struggles. And he says we have a great technology and education conference up here every February, in case you ever felt compelled to travel to Alaska in one of the coldest months of the year. For which, Jeffrey, I thank you for the invitation, but if I'm leaving Scotland in February, I am heading south. And much further south than Alaska as well.
How much coffee must they go through at a conference during that month in Alaska? They must just like hand out big thermoses when you walk in and say, here's your, you know, here's your program and here's your gallon of coffee for this morning.
Yeah, that's good. Getting up in that kind of temperature would be a killer. It's bad enough in Scotland where it's just wet, but
Well, you know, it's when he mentions that we all kind of share the same struggles. And I think that's been one of the values of the show for me and the people that have emailed me directly, is that we all kind of do seem to struggle with the same things. And so you often feel that like the problems you have are unique to your situation. But it's usually just the details and the names that are the unique parts, that you're generally all dealing with the same struggles with either kids not taking care of their devices or teachers not, you know, I guess, learning reverse scrolling and just all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, kids are kids and iPads are iPads, I guess. And for the most part, the thing that I find really weird is, as I've kind of become somebody who kind of travels, I guess, around the world to talk to schools, the weirdest thing about it is that I can sit down with almost any teacher from any country and we talk the same educational language. I mean, you're right that some of the names are different, but how is it that these countries that are all so different, school is the thing that's the same almost everywhere? Is weird. Okay, next feedback is from Dan Keeling, who says, I was listening to Apple Configurator Part 1, and I was wondering if you guys have found any good tools for distributing volume purchase program codes en masse in a personal model deployment. They're moving their one-to-one deployments from layered model to personal model and trying to find a good way to automate distributing the codes to the students. He says, is this something where MDM would really help? We're not seriously into MDM yet, but we just have a few devices in Meraki as a test. But if that would be vastly better or easier, we may be able to accelerate that. So I guess the answer to that is yes, MDM definitely helps a lot with that. ANDM is essentially the tool that automates distribution of volume purchase codes to people. Now, I was in exactly the same situation as Dan was a few months ago. I was thinking, do I really have to spend this money on Casper, or do I just kind of put it in the hands of the teachers and say, look, here's a piece of paper with a bunch of codes on it, just cut that up and give it out to your kids. And that might have worked at one time. But the more you think about the kind of, you know, what does that mean for your week or your working life, what it really means is that whatever child was absent that day from school, you're going to be chasing them to get their codes, and you're going to have an inconsistent set, and you're also not going to be able to see who's got what. So it's you're just going to constantly be having people coming to you going, I was off the day that, Keynote was handed out, so can I get a code for Keynote, and so on and so on. Whereas MDM is, you can set it up yourself, you can push to the devices you want to push to, and then you can see who's actually got it and who hasn't. And I think if you're looking at, and Dan says he's looking at 160 students total, this is in his AP classes in high school, I would definitely say at that scale, and that's not great scale, but it's about a little bit bigger than Cedars, you definitely want to be looking at MDM at that point. For sure.
Yeah, you just want to build your deployments where they can scale. And I think the way to look at it from a cost perspective is if you take the cost of Casper and divide it over 160 students, it's really not that expensive when you look at it that way. It's just one of those things. It's, I'm trying to think of a good example. It would be like buying a new CCTV system, but like not putting in the remote access for you to be able to monitor from anywhere in the school. It's just one of those things. It's like when you add it in, it really, really enhances what it can do. And so it's just one of those no brainers.
Yeah. And I think, based on last week's show, I think the strong message from Apple is that MDM is going to be the fundamental tool for managing one-to-one deployments going forward. So, and that was one thing that kind of, confirmed to me that doing MDM this year was right for us, was that getting some experience with it this year will be great, and then moving on to really doing more with it next year and essentially building the whole deployment on our MDM server is going to be the way ahead in the future.
Well, and I think that again goes back to, you've got to pick the right company for your MDM going forward. You don't want to pick some kind of fly-by-night company if you've got a pretty decent size deployment, and you're getting, the more you get invested into it, the harder it's going to be to switch.
That's exactly right. And I think a lot of people have experimented with Meraki, and I'm not saying that Meraki is not a perfectly good MDM, because it's fine. But a lot of people have chosen that because it's free. And that's a perfectly okay rationale for doing it, but it's important to be aware that that's why you're doing it. And I think going forward, it's going to become such a strategic part that you're going to want to think carefully about what you're doing. And I mean, I chose Casper for various reasons. That's not to say that Casper is the only one that I think is good. There are a substantial range of very good MDMs. I've seen Lightspeed. It's different from Casper, but it seems really good. I've looked at AirWatch in the past, and obviously there's Mobile Iron as well. Some of them are a little more enterprisey than education. And I think Casper, for education, I think Casper has slightly more of a focus on our sector, but I don't think that's really a deal maker at this point. What will be very interesting in time to come is which MDM vendors keep up with Apple. Like you said, Bradley, in the future, you want to have somebody you can trust. And in the iOS 7 timeframe, this is going to really sort of separate the men from the boys, if you like, as to who starts to support Apple's major initiatives in MDM quickly, and who are just doing basically inventory and pushing security profiles. Time will tell. I don't know. I'm not ready to predict. I'm not going to predict who's going to be the team to do that, but it will be interesting to see who does and who doesn't. Okay, next feedback. Eric asks a quick question concerning configurator and load times. Assuming a modern Mac with USB 3 and a USB 3 hub, does this make an appreciable difference in the time to copy apps, updates, and etc.? So Bradley, I guess the answer to this is probably not, because iPads aren't USB 3.
Correct. And you really have seen no discussion about that from anyone in the rumors of features on the new ones. And obviously they could add it with this next iPad. But then you kind of have to ask yourself the question, is that the future of managing iOS devices, even in the home? You know, is that the model that we follow? If you kind of buy into the way Apple wants you to do things, that you buy everything from them, it's all stored in iCloud, and if you get a new device, you just restore from that backup, and you don't even need to plug into sync.
Yeah, I think that's the hallmark of the personal model deployment, is that you are basically not connecting the iPad to anything. And I think as time goes on, you're going to see that tethered connections are going to be something that just doesn't scale. But of course, we are where we are today. But I think the answer is USB 3 and USB 3 hub, not so big a deal. I noticed substantial difference, though, between SSD-based Macs and non-SSD-based Macs. And I guess, SSD is faster for every application, but I was testing the Mac Mini that eventually became our Casper server was initially in my Apple configurator test bed, but I noticed a fairly big difference between, say, deploying, erasing and redeploying an iPad on my MacBook Air, which is, of course, all SSD, and doing it on the Mac Mini, which is hard drive based. So a modern fast Mac with an SSD will probably make more of a difference. Because when you do configurator, there are some things that you have to do which are kind of disk bound, for example, like unpacking iOS to reinstall it onto a device. That part would be speeded up with the faster disk on your machine. But in terms of the connectivity, you're still going to be limited to USB 2 speeds because the device itself isn't any faster than that.
Yeah, so we shall see this fall. It doesn't. I mean, it's not saying that USB 3 won't ever come, but I just don't know. I think it's much more likely that the next iPad and iPhone will see 802.11 AC more than USB 3.
And I don't think we're going to see a Thunderbolt iPad, do you?
That would be. Can you imagine how quickly it would be to sync? That would be incredible.
Yeah, I think at some level, Thunderbolt would be silly because I suspect, I don't have data on this, but I suspect that the flash in the iPad is not actually that fast. It feels like pretty low grade. It's not, high spec SSD stuff in there. It's just fairly basic flash memory. So it would be interesting. 128 gig iPad, could you fill it up more quickly over Thunderbolt? Of course, but I just don't think we're going to see that because iPads have to plug into Windows machines, you have to plug into PCs of all kinds. I think it's USB or it's something beyond a cable. I don't see them switching from USB for the cabled solution.
I had to get a new iPhone a few days ago. My sleep-wake button had become very flaky, and I was trying to wait until closer to when my warranty runs out to actually swap it. And so In years past, I actually had to send it to Apple, or you could pay a $30 kind of cross swap fee where they would send you one and you could mm-hmm. send yours back. Of course, if you argued with them enough, they would waive that. And I always argued based on the fact that the nearest Apple store was 2 hours from me. But then our local Mac reseller actually became like an authorized repair place for iPhones, like where they can swap okay. them out within warranty and things like that. And I was still just amazed by iCloud Restore and that it actually worked. Like I made a backup right before they swapped it, turned off iMessage and turned off FaceTime because that's very important when you're selling devices or swapping them out just so you can make sure that it deregisters, and handed them the iPhone. I come back within 20 minutes. They hand me a new iPhone that is with basically the setup screen. Sign in. It downloads within, I think, about 20 minutes. It downloaded all the apps I had. It was good to go, and it was really just perfect. The only thing I had to do, there's a few apps I had to log into again, and then I had to go in and generate a new application-specific password for my Google Apps email. Yep. But other than that, good to go. I wish there was a way to like do that within an app, like a Google Authenticator kind of style application where I mm-hmm. wouldn't have to like log in from a website to get one of those passwords.
Yeah, that is a bit of a pest because it's also, if you do it, say you go through 1Password, for example, it's really, with the way WebKit works on iOS, it's quite hard to copy and paste the one-time password. in the HTML because it's kind of, it's displayed in like four different blocks, so selecting the whole thing is quite hard on iOS. So yeah, some way of copying that would be really nice. Okay, we had two more to talk about here, Bradley. First one, Jeffrey Lill emails and says, a couple of quick comments. I think you might need to do a show on iPad cases. Not color, but the best for school use. I think it might be more than one show. I think it could probably be a month of iPad case discussion. But Jeffrey goes on, he says, there was a school down in Kent that I think had a ridiculous number of breakages. We've just had two dropped and the screen's broken out of 80 altogether. I don't think the Apple cover offers any real protection at all. I bought an in-tech case from Amazon for about £10, but they have slight weaknesses that expose the very corners of the iPad. Otter and Griffin do very heavy-duty versions, might be a bit overkill and costly, but my search goes on. And I think he's referring to a school that made the news down in England, in the UK here, where they had something like 50% breakage.
Wow.
I forget the exact number, but it was an astronomical number. And it was really interesting because all the press had an absolute field day with it. I felt terribly sorry for them because basically there was a quote in the article from the head teacher who said, he basically said, look, we got the wrong case. And once we got a better case, breakages went down to 2%. You know, so it wasn't that they were behaving badly with it or they were being careless. It was just that they had chosen a case that was not protective enough for the school environment, and they suffered for it pretty badly. And that was really a shame. But I think we've settled on a case called the Belkin Cinema Stripe Folio case, which is it's an interesting case because it can basically do two different stands in one. You know, the kickstand style where the foot of the iPad comes out and props against the front of the iPad case.
Mm-hmm.
It can do that, but it can also do a kind of fold round into a typing stand in the style of the first iPad case that Apple produced. So it does a bit of both. And it has on the inside of the case, the part where the iPad goes, it's a kind of leatherette case. And then on the inside part, there's a rubberized plastic frame that the iPad clips into, and that's stitched onto the case. So it holds the iPad by the four corners, so that all the corners are covered, but the edges are open as well, which is kind of important for some of the things you want to do with it. In particular, the one thing I was concerned about was that I'd used the Apple Smart Case in the past, and one of the problems it had was that it covers everything because you kind of clip the iPad into the whole back body of the case. And if you were recording audio or video and you shuffled your hands on the case, the sound would kind of be concentrated into the device's microphone. Whereas cases that don't cover all the edges, you can find a good way to hold it without necessarily transmitting that sound right into the microphone when you're recording.
I wonder, like, what are your floors made out of? Do you guys have carpet or some sort of like tile-based floor?
We've mostly got carpet over wooden floors in this school. A couple of solid floors, but mostly wooden, because our school has some basement space underneath.
Now, I wonder if I would love to see like the aggregate data on like how that percentage changes from, say, carpet to, you know, linoleum tile or ceramic tile or hardwood, and to see if that, like, you know, see if that impacts it all. And it may not, because, you know, ultimately, unless you've got really plush carpet, if you drop an iPad without a great case, it's probably going to crack anyways. So yeah, that's be interesting to see. Yeah, if you pick the wrong case and there are some drops, like they're just going to break it. There is that pendulum on how much you spend on cases versus your breakage. I mean, I think at some point it may be like, if you're spending $100 on a military grade type case for 150 devices, you end up getting pretty expensive pretty quick.
Yeah. I've spoken to some schools where their iPad insurance, the people who were insuring their devices basically demanded that they put them in a military spec case, and their insurance would be invalidated if they took them out of the case. I think that's overkill, but having just kind of been through the question of iPad lease insurance for a new deployment, my feeling is that the insurance industry are just freaking out about iPad deployments in schools right now in terms of the reliability. And we were being asked to purchase insurance that was, it was about 9.25% of the value of the goods every year of the lease. So we were eventually going to pay about 30% of the cost of one iPad just to insure it. And when our historic breakage rates are, 2 to 4% per year, and I'm being asked to pay 30% for insurance, that's a risk that I can easily afford to take. That may be different in different situations. I mean, I think the presence of carpet in the school does make a fair difference to the survivability of a drop and also getting the right case. But I think my kind of problem with the military spec case that we've all seen is that I think it kind of ruins the iPad. I mean, the device is elegant and light and slim and easy to handle, and then you put this massive case on it that turns it into something that's about the size of a little laptop, you know. And certainly the weight of it as well is kind of more than you'd really want to carry or hold. So I don't like those cases. I would never like to have one on my own iPad. And I think one of my kind of rules of thumb is that if I wouldn't like it on my iPad, I don't really want to put it out for the kids either.
No, I think that's fair, that you don't want to like make it where the thing weighs 45 pounds. John Siracusa talked about months ago how you can look at the iOS devices as kind of just a shell, and they basically send it to you with just like the guts, basically, and it's your decision how you dress that up, and where you go for different form factors, where you put, you know, jewels on it and beads, or you just leave it basically as an exposed shell. And that's just a decision you have to make, because there is a fine balance between never, you know, basically saying, okay, if this is dropped from the top of the building, we're not having a breakage. And you've got to decide for yourself internally, like, what are our goals here? And are we okay with like never having any breakage, or are we okay with having some because we have spares? And that allows us to save X amount on cases. And also, like, we makes the iPad, like, you know, X number of pounds lighter, X number of ounces lighter. That's an odd meeting request, like iPad case discussion, but it's a very important one because it affects the device. It's like having a discussion about, you know, how much RAM you're going to have. Like, you make the decision and you live with it for a few years.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the device. I mean, I understand sometimes why people do this, like the heavy defender cases. And if you're in a situation where, like, your iPad deployment has been really contentious and you've got somebody in your management team or outside the school, perhaps in a local authority or a school district who is very skeptical and has, you know, made statements to say, oh, these will definitely be damaged and so on. And if you have somebody who's going to jump down your throat the first time an iPad gets broken as a sign of doom, then I can understand why you might want to err on the side of, well, we're not going to have any breakages at all, and really, really defend the case more for political reasons than for actual technical or educational reasons. And that might be necessary for some people. It's unfortunate for people who are in that situation. You would hope that people would be more supportive than that, but there are certainly people who are willing iPad deployments to fail and are quite happy to jump on any sign, as they did down south, the press did, jump on any sign that this is not the right thing to do for schools. And sometimes you've got to respond to local concerns as well. But, you know, a broken iPad just isn't the end of the world. It's just not, you know. Half of them broken is much more of a problem. But, you know, one or two a year, it'll happen.
We have that with laptops. I mean, these, you know, laptops were not indestructible. I mean, I had laptops that got thrown up on. I mean, it's just things happen.
Yeah. I mean, if you drop a laptop, I mean, what laptop survives a drop intact?
Well, and your cost is drastically more expensive. I mean, if you we've got an 11-inch MacBook Air. If a student drops one of those in August, I'm out $1,000.
Yeah. And it's not as if these people are saying, well, you know, you can't possibly put computers in schools because they'll get broken. You know, laptops in schools because they'll get broken. And laptops do get broken because they're typically not deployed one-to-one. There's not that named accountability that we talked about before. And they're very often, you know, just completely abused. But nobody's going around saying, well, you shouldn't buy these expensive laptops for schools because somebody will break them. They'll get dropped and broken, which they do all the time. Nobody's making a big song and dance about that. But somehow, because it's iPads, you know, and people look at a glass screen and they think, oh, that can't survive. And in fact, you know, our instance of screen cracks is minimal for the most part. Somehow that's a big deal. And I guess it's just some people's mentality, but what can you do?
Are you deploying Bluetooth keyboards, or I mean, how are you guys dealing with keyboards, or do you just kind of have a block of them people can check out if they need to?
We have not deployed keyboards as a part of policy at all. We do have a few in the school, and what they're basically used in my class. So I teach programming, and the kids will edit their code on iOS. And one of the reasons we use a keyboard in that situation is because when you're programming, you're often reaching for symbols and obscure symbols, mathematical symbols at that, which are typically sometimes always on the second and sometimes even on the third keyboard mode on iOS. So it's pretty awkward to type a lot of those characters on iOS. So we got a set of Bluetooth keyboards for those kids. But what we do there is we actually, because I only have one class of that, I bought these £9 Bluetooth keyboards from Amazon, and I just said, look, here's your keyboard for the year, just keep it and give me it back at the end of the year. Now, Bluetooth is obviously, because you've got a pair of Bluetooth, it's a wee bit finicky to have a set in the class and have everybody repair them at the start of every class. And if you can imagine the scenario of having, you know, 10 or 15 people in a classroom trying to pair 10 or 15 Bluetooth keyboards at once, your chances of getting that correct are pretty slim. And this is, I don't know, have you seen this product, Bradley? I don't know if we've talked about it before, but Logitech have just brought out a wired iPad keyboard. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, I did. And as old school as that sounds, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, because that scenario I'm talking about, you know, say I had 6 computing classes, which I don't, but say I did. You know, I don't think I would want to buy 6 classes worth of Bluetooth keyboards and give them away. But what would make a lot more sense is to have, you know, one class set of keyboards that just sits in my room, and when people come in to program, they just grab a keyboard, plug it in, and they're ready to go. No pairing involved. And people were a bit sniffy about that product when it came out, but you know, anybody who's actually worked in education and tried to, you know, pair Bluetooth keyboards in a shared environment, that immediately made sense to everybody. I mean, it's just so obvious that that's something that you would want. So that's a pretty cool product. It's about $65, but it looks really durable. I have not held one. I have not used one. But they do have a 30-pin version and a lightning connector version. And I would really like to try that at some point and see if that might be a better way to go than buying really cheap Bluetooth keyboards and giving them away at the start of the year.
Well, and Bluetooth is on the 2.4 gigahertz band. And so it just, especially if you've got a class of, say, 20 students, that's just a lot more things on that band than you really, you know, necessarily have to have. Bluetooth is finicky. I mean, it seems like once a week I use an external Bluetooth keyboard and it's not the mouse. What do they call it? The external trackpad. And it will like disconnect. It'll disconnect for like 5 seconds once a week. And if you can imagine like trying to pair those every week, especially if they're changing what device they connect to, it's not the easiest technology to deal with.
Yeah. And we also use keyboards in exam conditions as well. And while we haven't never had a problem with the Bluetooth pairing or anything like that, a wired connection is just one less thing that can go wrong in such a critical situation.
Yeah, we'll have a link to Logitech's page on that in the show notes. Of course, I'm sure you can buy it at Amazon and your favorite local retailer, but I'll have a link to that in the show notes.
I think it's only just shipping maybe in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, it looks like it's $59.99 US, and then there is a 30-pin and a lightning connector. It really doesn't look too bad. It's pretty thin, pretty small. It's white. So,
yeah, it looks great. Yeah. Maybe we'll get one and try it out. Okay, last thing. Last piece of feedback. Alex Chan writes, he says, I've just finished reading Fraser's post about his iOS 7 education wish list, and I agree with the need to blacklist certain apps that get past the 17-plus restriction, but I was also wondering if you can whitelist certain apps that have a 17-plus restriction. So this is referring back to the idea that by configuration, we're going to put on a profile that says you can only have apps that are rated 12-plus or below and not 17-plus apps. He says, for example, I think you've both mentioned that you use 1Password, which we do, but the App Store gives that a 17-plus rating. If a student asked you if they could use 1Password or a similarly useful 17+ application, what would your policy be? And is there a way to allow this with current restrictions? So this is something I'm sure you've run into too, Bradley, where the general problem is that any application that provides a web browser of some kind gets a 17+ rating in the App Store. And 1Password, obviously, it keeps your passwords, but there's also a way that it basically has a built-in web browser, so you could use it as a replacement to Safari. Therefore, you can access content on the internet. Therefore, you can access naughty things. Therefore, it gets a 17+ rating. Okay, and I think really what's at the heart of this is that there's a problem with a 17+ rating, and Apple needs another flag in the App Store, which is, has a web browser built in.
Right? No, I agree. Yeah, because... it makes sense. The idea of what they've done makes sense, but there are becoming a lot of edge cases.
Yeah. I think the thing is that if there is a web browser, you should have some other control, like depending on not allowing 17+ applications as a way to prevent people from accessing the web is not fine-grained enough, right? There has to be, you know, this app has in itself 17+ content, you know, some kind of, swimsuit calendar app or whatever. That's obviously something that you wouldn't want to have on a student's device. But, I mean, I'm giving them access to Safari already, and I'm controlling that in other ways. So why would I, just because it has a web browser, why does that fall into 17+, right? And... I do agree that I think, you know, the idea that I had was that either you can blacklist certain apps that are under the 17+ rating, and the classic example there is Snapchat, right? Which is, you know, basically an app designed for sexting, which is rated 12+. It's not rated 17+, whereas 1Password gets a 17+ rating, and there are a lot of edge cases like that. Like, I want a 12+ rating on my device because there's so many applications that are about that level. But there are some I don't want, and there are some that are 17+ that I might want to allow. So Alex asks, you know, what would my policy be in that situation? And I think my policy would just be, sorry, you can't use it. Because if I allowed you to do it, it would open the door to so many completely inappropriate things that I couldn't open that door to you. I think that's what you'd have to do, because there is no blacklist and there's no whitelist at the moment. It would be a great feature in the future version of iOS. But at the moment, what I'm going to do about that is I'm going to, in Casper, you can create smart groups. And one of the criteria you can apply to a smart group is, has an application with a name like whatever you put in. So what I have is I set up in Casper a group for application name like Snapchat. So if anybody installs Snapchat and checks into the server, I'll get an email saying that a device has now joined the smart group of apps or of devices that have Snapchat installed. And that's the way I'm going to deal with that. But that's only for those apps which have a lower rating than I think they should have. There's really no way for me to allow people to use 1Password when I don't want them to use other 17+ applications.
That's a great option for iOS 8.
Yep, I'm telling you, the iOS 8 wish list is growing already.
And I'm sure in some ways Apple is in the same boat, where these edge cases that come up, and they're just, this is a new platform to them, just as it is us, and they don't have all the answers. I mean, Steve famously said it, you know, back when the iPhone 4 antenna debacle. He said, you know, we're just people running this company. And they don't know all these edge cases that will come up. And so I think that's why it's very helpful that a lot of, I think it's the rule that Apple's kind of trainers are former educators, like their education trainers are former teachers, because these environments are so different than, I guess, the consumer model, where you do have maybe more control. That an app like 1Password is a great application, and there should be a way to, like, get that onto a device with, with being able to control other things.
Yeah. I mean, I think really and truly, in large part, if they just had a flag that said, has a web browser built in, that would go a long way. And if that was a separate configuration control, could say, am I going to allow apps that have a web browser? Yes. Okay. Then we get 1Password. You know, 1Password, apart from its web browser feature, 1Password would be a 4+ rated application because it's just a password manager. You know, it doesn't have any, you know, there's no swimsuit mode in a 1Password. It's not a feature request either, I might add. But, you know, the fact that it's got the web browser is what gives it a 17+ rating, and that's too clumsy because it puts it in the same category as apps that really are not suitable for school at all. And I think there should be another axis of configuration there, I think, which is has a web browser or doesn't have a web browser. And if I'm allowing Safari, there's no reason I can think of why I wouldn't want to allow 1Password as well, except that it's put in this category with apps that I really don't want to allow.
It'll be interesting thinking back to the iOS 7 keynote, the password management that's in iOS 7 now. It'll be interesting to see how that's actually used in education, you know, how much training is put into that, and educating, you know, teachers about unique passwords, because we talk about that often, but, you know, without something like 1Password, there's just no good way to do it.
Yeah, it's passwords have to go away. Yeah, I guess 2-factor's part of that. And we're getting through that as well. You know, quick update on our 2-factor saga. I think we're about 50% done now, and I'm down to, in terms of sitting down and converting a teacher to 2-factor, it's probably down to about 15 minutes per teacher, which also involves making application-specific passwords for their iPad mail and their phone mail and so on. But they're getting pretty close to being done with that, and hopefully by the end of the summer we'll be finished that little project.
Well, you know what'll happen is you'll do all this, and then in iOS 7 they'll have like support for Google two-factor within like the iPad mail, where it'll like, you know, once you put in your, you know, login, it'll ask for it in that like kind of web browsery look, and it'll make it like super easy, and you will have gone through all this trouble, and it would have
As long as they just don't break Google Authenticator, that'll be fine.
That app has not been updated in a long time.
Yeah. I guess it does what it has to do, but it doesn't fit the iPhone 5 yet either. So I guess whenever they do update it for iOS 7 compatibility, they're going to have to make it work for the iPhone 5 as well, because apparently Apple now doesn't accept any updates to apps, iPhone apps, that don't fit the iPhone 5 correctly.
That is true.
Yeah. Good on them. So that's the show. That's all our feedback for now. Thank you to everybody who emails in. I really appreciate all the feedback. It's interesting to hear all the things that you're concerned about. Maybe we'll try and schedule an iPad case show at some point and hear what people are saying. It would be really nice to actually hear from somebody who makes iPad cases and get some information on what they're seeing and how they're hearing from people whose devices have either survived or not survived, drops and spills and breaks and so on. So maybe we'll try and organize that at some point.
That would be a great kind of video show to do, where we could have like, you know, handful of cases and we could talk about them and look at the installation process, and that would be a fun show.
We could do a little kind of will it blend kind of thing where we just drop iPads all day. Will it survive? Crash. Okay, so let's leave it there, Bradley. Let's let people know, we haven't done this in a while, let people know where they can find us online. Spears.org, SPEIRS.org for me is my blog. Fraser Spears on Twitter. Where can people find you, Bradley?
My blog is chambersdaily.com, and I'm at Bradley Chambers on Twitter and app.net.
Okay, so let's leave the show there for today, and we'll catch up again next week.
Have a good week, everybody.